This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive. This free program is paid for by the listeners of WBAI New York. If you're not already a member, think about joining us to help keep free speech alive.
And it's 2 p.m. Stay tuned for the Arts Magazine.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Arts Magazine. This is Prairie Miller, and on the show today in the Arts Magazine screening room, Jobless at the Movies, how the unemployed signed up for the Hollywood film Up in the Air, a conversation with director Jason Reitman, and Pirate Radio, The Boat That Rocked, the Pirate Radio Rock Revolution, and some thoughts from star Philip Seymour Hoffman on doing the radio DJ thing in a movie.
And I'm Marianne Miller. J51, ever heard of it? Well, you'll be hearing a lot about it in the program today. And as my guests, I have Ed Rosner, a retired criminal lawyer who found out that Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village, had the J51 tax abatement. And the lawyer who won the case, Alex Schmidt, welcome both. Talk about it later in the program.
First, some scenes from Up in the Air and George Clooney as a cross-country downsizer firing workers for corporations so they don't have to.
Last year, I spent 322 days on the road.
I flew 350,000 miles.
The moon is 250. All the things you probably hate about traveling are warm reminders that I am home.
Welcome back, Mr. Bingham.
I am a passenger.
I work for a company that lends me out to cowards that don't have the courage to sack their own employees, and for good reason.
Who are you, man?
Because people do crazy stuff when they get fired. I'm going to need your key card. How much does your life weigh? Imagine for a second that you're carrying a backpack. I want you to pack it with all the stuff that you have in your life. You start with the little things, the things on shelves and in drawers, the knickknacks. You start adding larger stuff. Clothes, tabletop appliances, lamps, your TV. Backpack should be getting pretty heavy now. You go bigger. Your couch, your car, your home. I want you to stuff it all into that backpack. Now, I want you to fill it with people. Start with casual acquaintances, friends of friends, folks around the office. And then you move into the people that you trust with your most intimate secrets. Brothers, your sisters, your children, your parents, and finally your husband, your wife, boyfriend, your girlfriend. You get them into that backpack. Feel the weight of that bag. Make no mistake, your relationships are the heaviest components in your life. All those negotiations and arguments and secrets and compromises. The slower we move, the faster we die. Make no mistake, moving is living. Some animals were meant to carry each other, to live symbiotically over a lifetime. Star-crossed lovers, monogamous swans. We are not swans. We're sharks.
Sharks, indeed. And that was George Clooney bragging about the rewards to be had in victimizing your fellow man. At least according to the character he plays in Jason Reitman's Up in the Air, one of a number of remarkable feature films coming out lately about being fired or barely making ends meet, including two out this week in which supermarket workers get to wreck the stores a little bit that treated them badly. Humble Pie, now out on DVD, and Gigante from Uruguay. More about that later. First, a little about Up in the Air. If there's a job that can be viewed as even more loathsome than, say, IRS investigator or debt collector, it's George Clooney's odious occupation in the not exactly uplifting downsizing satire Up in the Air. As carefree corporate hitman, Clooney is Ryan Bingham, an outsourced specialist in firing workers for big business so they don't have to. But the self-satisfied and self-possessed workforce mop-up maven could care less about the damaged lives he leaves in his wake. For Ryan, it's all about frequent flyer miles in the skies that he counts as home more than any grounded turf, and his lifetime aspiration of racking up the magic number of 10 million. Directed and co-written by Juno director Jason Reitman and based on the novel by Walter Kim, the inadvertently prophetic Up in the Air was conceived before the current national economic crisis, but is a more than welcome addition to the typical shallow Hollywood, more focused on gross-out jokes and creative killing. With tangy, sarcastic dialogue and brilliantly brash attitude that cuts to the core, Up in the Air is both brutally entertaining and profoundly in touch with the everyday reality of audience lives. And whether or not such pink slip itinerant suits exist in real life is beside the point. Ryan couldn't be more thrilled to be pimped out to companies while specializing in screwing their employees because he believes he's dumping those workers with an imagined elegant personal touch rather than utterly destroying their lives. So when old school Ryan may be about to get a taste of his own medicine and have his wings cut, so to speak, by young high-tech efficiency expert Natalie, played by Anna Kendrick, midlife crisis doubts suddenly materialize about an existence devoted to determined transience along with compassion and commitment avoidance at all costs. It seems that internet specialist Natalie has a cheaper, less emotionally interactive, and more swiftly robotic method of dumping workers via remote video conferencing on the internet, and while never having to leave one's computer terminal for pricey flights around the country. Kind of like, say, executions via lethal injection instead of those messy firing squads. All of which forces Ryan to seriously rethink his priorities on the planet, or rather while circling it, in particular his literally fly-by-night ongoing erratically charged, though elusive affair with enigmatic fellow corporate nomad, Alex Gorin, played by Vera Farmiga. I met with Jason Reitman, and he described the process of hiring real laid-off workers to be in the movie, where the idea came from, and also the concept of firing people online as even worse than a face-to-face pink slip, and the irony of Reitman sitting down with the press to talk about this movie, a profession itself whose ranks have been so decimated by the economic crisis, including a number of worker suicides.
When I first started writing this movie, it was 2003, and we were at the tail end of an economic boom. And as I approached the actual shooting of the film, we were now in one of the worst recessions on record, and I had to adjust how we were doing these firing scenes. To do it as pure satire just didn't make sense anymore. We were shooting the film in St. Louis and Detroit, two cities that just got pummeled, and we put an ad out in the paper asking if there was people who had lost their jobs who wanted to be in a documentary about job loss. We'd set a documentary to kind of weed out actors who were trying to, you know, sneak into the film. And we got a startling amount of responses. We ended up putting 60 people on camera, 22 of which who are in the film. We would interview them for about 10 minutes on what it's like to lose their job in this kind of economy. And after that, we would actually fire them on camera. We'd ask them to either respond the way they did the day they lost their job, or if they preferred the way they wished they had responded. And it was kind of an incredible experience to watch the these non-actors improv with 100% realism. I think the situation was so real for them that they couldn't help but just get into the moment instantaneously. The moment they started to hear that kind of, we would use the that kind of legal document that is used, you know, to fire people with, and the second they would hear that legal verbiage, you'd see their eyes turn, and they would just go there, and it was a remarkable experience. The technology really was just again, an underlying idea that was already in the book, which is how disconnected that we've become. And the kind of insidious thing about technology is it makes us think we're closer. You can have 1,000 friends on Facebook, but you don't ever actually see them. And so the technology makes us think we're closer when we actually don't look each other in the eyes anymore. And the firing people online seemed like a wonderful dilemma for Ryan Bingham in that, in a certain sense, it's everything he wants. You know, he wants life to be more impersonal. He doesn't want to be connected to people. But at the same time, it pulls him off the road. And he does see a certain dignity in how he does his job. So I thought it would work nice.
You mentioned that you embarked on this movie before the economic crisis. And as members of the media, we've been especially hard hit by unemployment. And we've had a number of suicides, one just a few weeks ago here in New York. And I was wondering how you feel this film takes on new meaning for you after the economic crisis kicked in.
Well, it certainly had more gravity, and that's not to say that you can't make dark comedy in a dark situation, but I had to take it a lot more seriously. But again, I don't want it to be confused. This is not a movie about firing people. This is really a movie about one man trying to figure out who and what he wants in his life, and the location for that is this economy, and the location is the occupation of termination. One of the best things my father ever told me about filmmaking was to understand the difference between your story and your location. And the way he told me was the strangest thing. One day he was like, you have to come over and watch 24. I was like, the television show with Kiefer Sutherland? Yes, it's amazing. You have to come over and watch it. Okay. I went to his house. He, like, sat me down. We watched. It was the season one. And it was. It was great. He was right. I couldn't believe I hadn't been watching it. And I said, Dad, why is this show so good? There's tons of shows on TV about terrorism. What makes this one special? He goes, it's not about terrorism. Terrorism is the location. This is a TV show about a man trying to keep his family together. I was like, oh, my God, you're right. The other shows are all about terrorism. This is a movie. This is a show about Sutherland trying to keep his family together. And I don't know why, but that was a moment that kind of cracked open this idea for me that you have to understand the difference between location and plot. And this is a movie where the location, yes, is a horrible comedy economy. It adds gravity, and certainly there's a correlation between a man who's searching for a purpose in his life juxtaposed against the people that he's firing who are now all searching for purpose in their own lives. But I never allowed his job or, you know, the state of this economy to take over what was more important, which is the fact that there is something exhilarating about being alone, about waking up in a city where you have nothing and know nobody. And I was looking into why that is. I have a very complete life. I'm married. I have a beautiful daughter. I get to do what I want for a living, what I love. And yet I still think about that. And I was curious why. And I'm with each of my films trying to ask a question, and I'm always fortunate enough to find an author like Walter who has the great verbiage and the ability to actually write, where I can actually steal from him all his ideas and then, you know, throw them out as my own.
And that was writer-director Jason Reitman talking about his latest film, Up in the Air, which opens in theaters this Friday. Reitman's sharply honed script doesn't mince words, dramatically or politically, as Ryan's opportunistic boss sticks it to Clooney's servile henchmen. While Reitman's genius move of hiring real-life people out there who've actually been fired exquisitely proves the exception to the rule that you have to be an actor to both dazzle and devastate audiences in a movie. Now, while Reitman feels audiences will be far more interested in the character of the victimizer rather than the victims of joblessness in his film, I have a hunch that it's going to be the other way around, especially in the face of the current soaring economic crisis and unemployment figures in the ghettos that have now reached Great Depression proportions, but which apparently hasn't stopped CNN from embarking on a loathsome new practice, a kind of American Idol for the jobless. For those who have seen this periodic presentation on CNN, Jobless listeners are invited to come on the air and beg for work, but they have to beat the clock, a 30-second spot that ticks away while they plead for a job and shuts off after the 30-second limit. Infotainment reaches a new low at CNN. This is the Arts Magazine on WBAI in New York, and now I'll turn to another subject that always comes up around this time of year, movie awards. And here's my pick for Best Soundtrack in Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. Now, the soundtrack may not make waves at the Oscars, but it's sure to win where it counts, the hearts and minds of the masses. First, a few words from Michael Moore.
I remember thinking during the Katrina flood, why is it always the poor who have to suffer the misery? Why isn't it ever Bernie Madoff up on the roof screaming for help? Or the head of Citibank, or the hedge fund guys at Goldman Sachs, or the CEO at AIG? It never is these guys, is it? It's always those who never got a slice of the pie, because these men took it all and left them with nothing, left them to die. I refuse to live in a country like this, and I'm not leaving. You know, I can't really do this anymore, unless those of you who are watching this in the theater want to join me. I hope you will. And please, speed it up.
Arise, ye workers from your slumber. Arise, ye prisoners of want. That's right. For reason in revolt now thunder. Chains of hatred, greed, and fear. Ha ha! Away with all your superstitions. Serve our masses. Arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. So comrades, come on and rally. Then the last fight let us face. The international unites the whole darn human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight let us face. The international unites the whole. On tyrants only we'll make war. The soldiers too will take strike action. They'll break ranks and fight no more. And if those cannibals keep trying to sacrifice us to their pride, each at the forge must do their duty, and we'll strike while the iron is hot. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole beautiful human race. So comrades, come on, let's go rally. Ha! And the last fight, let us face. The international unites the whole.
Was Tony Babbino performing a very new and different rendition of the Internationale in Michael Moore's Capitalism, A Love Story. Now, another film out there I'd like to say a few words about, especially because this is radio, is the Richard Curtis satire Pirate Radio. The whole notion of pirate radio or liberated underground radio, even though the idea is as old as radio itself, seems to be of particular interest right now because of the looming potential co-opting of the Internet. And radio was once as open and free in mass participation as the Internet is now. pirate radio was in subversive populist reaction to the seizure by government and commercial forces of the airwaves for the purposes of political control, propaganda, and profit that we're stuck with now. In the film Pirate Radio, a band of rowdy British DJs and one American, played by Philip Seymour Hoffman, set up broadcasting on a vessel in the North Sea after a British government crackdown against rock and roll in the 1960s. And here's some of the trailer for Pirate Radio.
It was loud, it was rebellious, and in 1966, the British government banned rock and roll on the radio.
That's the whole point of being the government. If you don't like something, you simply make it illegal.
Until one American DJ...
I don't give a hoot nanny about your limey laws.
He's possibly the most famous broadcaster ever.
And a band of renegades...
You must be the Count!
I am he. Take me to the microphone!
...launched a radio station on the high seas...
We should have set sail years ago.
...and raided the airwaves.
Let's have a tune. I'm sick of this silence.
I'm the Count. You're listening to Radio Rappers. We count down to ecstasy.
Rock on!
Are you doing something dirty?
And that was for Erica.
Ow! They had millions of fans. A boat full of treasure.
Busy day.
And the full attention.
Pirate Radio.
Of the authorities.
That will soon be the first person cursed on rock and roll radio.
Here it comes.
Shut that filth
up. And we're going to shut them down.
They can't close us down. We're pirates.
They will find a way. Governments loathe people being free.
Our heroic disc jockeys become dangerous criminals.
About the untold story.
I'm declaring war.
Of the motley crew that saved rock and roll.
This is a trick.
We've got the wrong damn boat.
Spectacular mistake.
They will come after us.
Let them try. I intend to broadcast from this ship until the day I die. For a couple days after that.
Young men and young women will always dream dreams and put those dreams in the song.
Pirate Radio.
Let's rock! Us! Us! Twat! Us!
Don't know what that means. I didn't understand any of that.
Now, some of us in the press met with Philip Seymour Hoffman, who plays the only American DJ on board the pirate vessel. Hoffman, who was nominated last year for an Oscar for his role as a priest accused of being a pedophile in the film Doubt, is well known not only for opting to play unusual and eccentric characters on screen, but for also defying, with his portly persona, any prevailing conventional notion of what a leading man should look like. Good for him. And Hoffman is perhaps best known for his role as the late legendary irreverent rock critic Lester Bangs in Almost Famous. First, Hoffman shares thoughts on where his passion for acting comes from, also not a typical reply. Then he considers whether or not being a radio personality is really being an actor at the same time, since he's had an opportunity to sample both in Pirate Radio. Here's Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Oh, God, I don't know. I first had a great passion for theater as a patron. When I was about 12 or 13, I was a patron of theater, and I loved it. Huge passion for it. I just did. Why that is, I don't know. What I did. And so that's really what it still is. How I got on the other side of it is really, I'm still trying to find out whether that was a mistake or not, you know. And I mean that half jokingly and half not in a way, meaning because my passion truly was seeing, watching. It was going to the theaters is really, I think, one of the rare gifts that we have that a culture can offer a person. You know, and so I learned that at such a young age has a lot to do with probably why I became involved with trying to create it myself, whether it be live theater or film, why I've directed and acted, why it hasn't just been acting. You know what I mean? That there's obviously, I have an interest in the whole thing. I've produced things, I've directed, that it's out there. I have an interest in being involved in things that hopefully will affect or will give, will be a reason for someone to go like I have reason to go.
How would you compare and contrast acting with someone who's broadcasting on the air and performing in that way?
Well, I think they're all in the same family in a way. They're all in the same family in a way, but I think that I would relate more being a radio personality to maybe being a writer than being an actor, because a radio person is trying to find their voice, I think. That would be my guess, is that they start out and they're trying to figure out who they are and how they sound and what they do. And, you know, and I think writers are like that. Actors aren't like that. Actors aren't trying to find, because they're not going to just do one thing. They're actually trying to find a way to do that with many different voices. Do you know what I mean? So each job is like saying I'm not that DJ anymore. I have to be another DJ. I just figured out how to play that DJ. Now no one cares about that DJ. Now I have to play this DJ. It's a different thing, but off the top of my head, I think it might be a little more similar to being a writer. I would think. And writers find their, you know what I mean, great writers, they find their voice, and you look forward to hearing it. You know.
And that was Philip Seymour Hoffman, star of Pirate Radio, which chronicles a wild and rebellious period in radio broadcasting, but is a little too giddy and manic at times when it comes to British humor. Pirate Radio is in theaters now. And here's a look at some other films out there right now. Brothers. Why do these patriotic Hollywood war movies act like U.S. soldiers are innocently simply taking a stroll through, in this case, Afghanistan, and are then captured and gleefully tortured by insurgents in elaborate ways resembling, well, Abu Ghraib? In Brothers, a Marine played by Tobey Maguire suffers post-traumatic stress syndrome because the Taliban force him to kill a fellow soldier, and not because the U.S. military sent him there to kill in the first place. Brothers, a preposterous, blame-the-victim, elephant-in-the-room, military tall tale. The Road. While identifying with characters in a bad situation is a movie audience must, drowning in their deep funk as much as they do is a narrative no-no. Based on the Cormac McCarthy End of the World Doomsday Downer bestseller and starring Charlize Theron, The Road is a dreary travelogue with an accent on cannibalism and an utterly exhausting affair likely to leave audiences nearly as perpetually pooped as the family in flight around the planet. Gigante. Taxi driver's toned-down, plus-size Travis Bickle meets Marty in this refreshing Latin American take on human labor beyond the usual drudgery playing out in Uruguay. Gigante crosses the line back and forth between dark and delightful, and supermarket security guard surveillance duty and the object of his voyeuristic infatuation. Eventually, the pudgy protagonist summons enough courage to hit on his fellow employee and get even with the store management, too. Also into a get-even-against-supermarket-management smash-up mode while dealing with weight issues is the portly, sad-sack store clerk in Humble Pie, just out on DVD. And what's really special about yet another spotlight on unusually large people, following Precious and The Blind Side, is that screenwriter and star Hubble Palmer knows all about appetite and the plight of eating disorder addiction, along with working class rage, speaking with humor and sensitivity from his own life. This is Prairie Miller, and you're listening to The Arts Magazine on WBAI in New York and streaming on the web at WBAI.org. Coming up at 3 p.m. is Hugh Hamilton with Talkback. And now here's Marianne Miller.
Thank you, Prairie. And my guests are Alex Schmidt and Ed Rosner. Welcome both to The Arts Magazine. All right, we're going to discuss J-51 tax abatement. You think anybody knows what it is? Alex?
Well, I imagine by now a number of tenants who live in buildings that receive J-51 benefits have heard about the Roberts v. Tishman Speyer decision. and that they've learned a little bit through the public reports of that decision as to what the issue is all about.
And congratulations on your win at Stuyvesant Town Peter Cooper Village.
Well, thank you very much. It's
basically, it was that the owners, the current owners, Tishman Speyer, and the former owner, Metropolitan Life, could not deregulate apartments while simultaneously receiving tax benefits.
That's correct. J51 tax benefits, which were specifically designed to promote and sustain the stock of affordable housing in New York City, and were granted to the owners on the condition, express condition, that they maintain all of the units in their buildings as rent-stabilized units.
Now, automatically with that decision, every apartment that was re-regulated in Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village, and any other apartment building, regardless of size, went back to rent regulations?
Well, that's certainly partly our interpretation of the Court of Appeals decision, and we think that is what the Court of Appeals intended to rule, although I have to carve out an exception for certain small buildings. I mean, if there's a building receiving J51 benefits that has five or less rental units in it, the J51 restriction does not apply to those buildings. Also, buildings that are owned as cooperatives or condominiums, which may have rental units, also are not restricted by the Roberts decision. But certainly it's our position that as to every other kind of building, the Court of Appeals made pretty clear that apartments should not have been deregulated and should not be deregulated in the future if they're receiving J51 benefits.
All right. And Ed Rosner, you discovered that Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village, had indeed the J51 tax abatement.
That's correct.
Would you consider yourself a whistleblower?
Well, some people might consider that whistleblowing. I don't know. Depends how you define the term.
Okay. And you were involved in Independence Plaza legal action.
That's correct.
Seth Miller, your lawyer, who is now flying back from Las Vegas, would have been here with us today, but he will come another time. So that was the impetus for the lawsuit, then.
Well, you mean the impetus for Stuytown's lawsuit?
Yeah.
Well, when Stuytown learned that they had a J51 and it looked into it and realized the consequences of it, they very wisely instituted their lawsuit, and we see the results of it. I think the court got it right, and I'm very happy to see that that result was reached.
And your case with Independence Plaza, you expect a decision in January
next year? Yes.
And there's no reason to think that it would be any different than Stuyvesant.
Well, I mean, the facts are somewhat different, but the central principle that underlies the Roberts decision, which as I read it, is that if you have a J51 tax abatement, you must be rent regulated at least for the life of the abatement. And beyond, if the landlord has failed to give the tenants the required J51 notices, which most landlords, including the landlord at Independence Plaza, failed to do, so that even after the end of the tax abatement period, those tenants who continue in possession or occupancy of their apartment will remain rent-stabilized or rent-regulated until they voluntarily vacate their apartment. Mm-hmm. And when I say those tenants, that includes those who have succession rights as well.
Right. Alex, how many apartments do you think this decision will affect in New York City?
Well, we know it's about 4,400 apartments in the Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village complexes. How many beyond that? We ourselves do not have.
There have been estimates as up to 100,000
units. The industry is actually, the landlords themselves and their trade groups have estimated that it could be 8,000 units beyond the two complexes, and they've also estimated that it could be 80 to 100 or 200,000 units.
Yeah.
And it could be that both estimates are correct. The 8,000 units, assuming it's true, may apply to apartments where the tenants actually have rent overcharge claims as a result of the landlord's unlawful deregulation. And that would apply in areas into buildings where the market rates and the market rate leases are at rents that are higher than the permissible rent stabilized rents would have been. However, for the vast majority of apartments affected by this decision, which could coincide to the $80,000 or $100,000 or $200,000 figure that we've heard estimated, are likely apartments where the legal rent is actually above what the market rent is. So those tenants may not have rent overcharge claims, but they still have a claim to be restabilized.
And
under this
rent
ruling.
Regulated with all the protections that go with it.
That's correct, including the right of renewal and succession rights.
I understand that with the lease, when the landlord was getting this tax abatement, with the leases that they signed for the new apartments, weren't they supposed to put a rider on that they were supposed to... They weren't allowed to deregulate the apartments.
Under the rent stabilization law, there is a provision that requires a landlord of a rent stabilized apartment that's receiving J51 benefits to provide a notice in every lease and every renewal of that lease that it intends to deregulate the apartment on expiration of the J51 benefit period. It's unclear, however, how that applies to landlords who were thinking that they had deregulated market rate apartments and were issuing leases for those apartments that have now been re-regulated or will be re-regulated under this ruling.
Right. Ed?
In my view, the law is clear. If you have a J51 and you're a landlord, you're required to give the tenants notice. In 12-point type, no less, in every lease and renewal thereof, of the fact that you have the J51 and the approximate date as to when it's going to end. The law is also clear that if you fail to do that, by mistake or otherwise, it doesn't have to be a willful failure, the tenant continues to be regulated beyond the period of the tax abatement for as long as they occupy their apartment. So that if you have a situation where someone claims, well, I didn't do it because I didn't realize that I was required to do it, the answer is simple. Had you read the law and understood it, had you gotten appropriate advice, you would have known that you were required to do this, and you're presumed to know what you should have known. And in that circumstance, it is simply not an acceptable explanation or excuse to say, I did not know.
Ignorance of the law is no whatever, right?
Absolutely. And certainly in a situation such as this, where you can expect a landlord who knew enough to apply for the abatement to learn what the responsibilities he was assuming were when he got it.
And even if he didn't apply for the abatement, his predecessors, and he inherited it when he bought it,
well,
correct?
When you buy a property, and these properties are purchased for vast sums, presumably you have a title search done and an analysis made as to what you're buying, what you're getting, and you should be on notice, as was the landlord in Independence Plaza, who was put on notice by his title searches and other studies that there was a J51, and he knew what the consequences of that were. And despite that, he saw fit to purchase the property and continued to accept the tax abatement after buying it for essentially 2 years until we commenced the lawsuit. And then all of a sudden said, I think I better return that portion of the abatement that I took after leaving the Mitchell Lama program. There's simply no excuse for such behavior.
Guilty.
Guilty as charged.
Guilty as charged. Giving the money back after you rob a bank doesn't count, right?
I've never heard of anyone successfully using that as a defense.
Okay. Now, Alex, DHCR, what was their role in this? And weren't they the watchdog for the tenants, but yet they allowed this to come about.
Well, the DHCR, in addition to being the watchdog for the tenants, I think has a public duty to balance the necessarily competing interests of landlords and tenants, and to arrive at what they earnestly believe in good faith are decisions that are in the best interests of the overall community, which includes both landlords and tenants. Their role in this was perhaps unwitting. The evidence is not all in yet, but their official position in December of 1995, after the 1993 deregulation statute was passed containing the J51 exception, was that, like the Court of Appeals ruled in Roberts, any building receiving J51 benefits had to remain rent-stabilized. The industry did lobby the DHCR for a alternative interpretation of the statute. And after being unsuccessful at least once, if not more often, the industry in January of 1996 succeeded in obtaining a private letter ruling from a deputy commissioner of the DHCR saying that the industry's alternative interpretation was a feasible alternative to the official DHCR position. However, that letter specifically warned the industry not to consider the letter as a substitute for formal agency action. In other words, it told the industry, the reasonable interpretation of the letter is that it warned the industry not to follow the letter, but to follow the official position. And there's an open question as to whether or not that assistant commissioner or the DHCR at any point was ever made aware by the industry or any other source of a debate in the Senate in 1993, whereby the sponsor of the deregulation bill made very clear that under no circumstances should any building receiving J51 benefits ever be deregulated. Had the DHCR been made aware of that debate, as the Court of Appeals was later made aware of that debate, perhaps the DHCR never would have issued the private letter ruling, and certainly perhaps the DHCR never would have changed its official position as it did in December of 2000, formally adopting the landlord's position.
In the case of Stuyvesant Town Roberts versus Tishman Speyer, did the landlords try to use that? They were told it was okay by the Division of Housing and Community Renewal?
Yes, certainly. They tried to justify their conduct based initially on the 1996 letter, informal letter opinion, and then once the DHCR's official position changed in December of 2000, then the landlords had a regulatory reason that for deregulating buildings, notwithstanding receiving the J51 benefit. So they did try to rely on it. However, it's well settled in New York as well as elsewhere that an agency that is a unelected body of officials whose duty it is to implement and administer statutes cannot change statutes. They cannot change the law. And the Court of Appeals in the Roberts decision correctly found that that's what happened here. The December 2000 regulation effectively rewrote the statute in a way that enabled landlords who were receiving public assistance in the form of J51 benefits that were specifically targeted to maintain the stock of affordable housing. They were using that money instead to deregulate, and using it for the precise opposite purpose for which the money was intended.
Now, I take it there is no agency, city or state, that will inform a tenant, you are in a J51 tax abatement building, therefore your apartment is re-regulated. The onus is on the tenant.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily agree that the DHCR at some point will not issue such notifications to tenants. The DHCR, for some reason, is not taking an official position yet, despite the Court of Appeals ruling in Roberts. And I think it does have a public duty to implement Roberts. And I would encourage the DHCR to take a look at the major open issue that the Court of Appeals left open, which was this issue of retroactivity, and use its lawyers to do the research, look at the briefs that we filed in the Court of Appeals, and analyze the retroactivity issue. And once they do that, I'm very confident that they will realize that the retroactivity issue is really a non-issue. It's the doctrine of non-retroactivity is pretty much a dead doctrine legally. And the New York Court of Appeals has a case that's really directly on point with the Roberts case. It's a case called Gurney versus Aetna Casualty, which makes very clear that in circumstances identical to the circumstances at issue here, there is no issue of non-retroactivity. The Court of Appeals decision in Roberts, under its earlier decision in Gurney, will be retroactive. And I think the DHCR, it's incumbent upon them to do that analysis and start ensuring that buildings throughout the city start being re-regulated if they receive J51 benefits.
But until that time, it's up to the tenant to find out if they're in a J51. I live in a Steve Croman building, and we did find out that he was getting a J51. He bought it with the building, but yet went ahead and deregulated apartments. We've also found out that he has 15 other buildings. Now, what would be the best way for the tenants in these buildings to get their apartments re-regulated? Would there be a class action suit? Should it be individuals? Can an organization begin the suit? Can a non-market rate tenant begin the suit, or everything?
Well, all of those are certainly possibilities. What we've been encouraging people to do, if they are in a J51 building where there are rent overcharge complaints that are viable claims, that they should bring a class action, because by doing so, they will toll what's known as the statute of limitations and protect everybody in their building who's affected from losing money in the future by filing a claim later and then thereby losing some of their past damages under the statute of limitations. That's certainly one way of doing it. Another way of doing it would be for tenants in J51 buildings where there are no rent overcharge issues, because, again, the legal rent stabilized rate may exceed the market rate. To also bring a class action, but a different kind, rather than for reimbursement of past overcharges, strictly a class action seeking an injunction or a declaration that the building should be rent stabilized going forward and that all the residents in that building should have their rent stabilized status and the legal protections attendant thereto restored to them immediately.
There is something else that can be done. In addition or in place of bringing a class action or instituting a suit in Supreme Court, overcharge complaints and other kinds of complaints can be filed with DHCR. And, of course, there is essentially a four-year statute of limitations. They ordinarily will look back to determine only 4 years to determine the base rent. But there is developing an exception to the four-year look-back rule. And that is where there is fraud involved. There is a default formula that may be employed, which traditionally has been the agency will look to the lowest rent for a comparable apartment in the same line that the tenant in question is occupying. And that lowest rent may be the base rent. So one may conclude that rather than proceeding in Supreme Court, which has what they call concurrent jurisdiction, they may be better off with the current DHCR proceeding there administratively and seeking relief from the agency rather than proceeding by a class action in Supreme Court, or if not a class action, just an action in Supreme Court.
Ed, you're a former criminal lawyer.
That's correct.
You mentioned the fraud. Do we have a RICO case here, racketeering and criminal? I want to see them all wearing striped suits.
Well, RICO, of course, is a federal criminal statute involving racketeering enterprises. There's also a civil aspect to it. There's a possibility that there is such, but you don't have to actually get into that. There's even a New York State equivalent to RICO. It's called enterprise corruption. But in terms of the tenants getting their due without regard to pursuing a criminal prosecution, there are means readily available, both by going to DHCR with an overcharge complaint if there is such a situation, and also if you want additional stabilization rights that haven't been accorded to you, you can file complaints there, or you can proceed as Alex suggested in Supreme Court in a class action or otherwise.
Yeah, well, one thing I would mention, Ed is absolutely right. Tenants can go to the DHCR, although the one difference there is that the tenant would only be protecting him or herself by doing so. And by filing a class action lawsuit, the tenant will be protecting similarly situated tenants throughout the building. And so it might make sense for buildings for residents in buildings to join class actions for that reason.
That assumes that the class would be certified. But going beyond that, for example, in IPN, we in 2008 filed a few hundred overcharge complaints with DHCR and had two cases that were pending in Supreme Court at our request over the opposition of the landlord transferred to DHCR, and it's now conceded that the decision made by DHCR will apply to all tenants in IPN. And we expect a more expeditious and correct determination there than we might have gotten in Supreme Court, where the case was proceeding at a very slow pace, unfortunately.
I also know that in this ruling of Roberts versus Tishman Speyer, that the high income decontrol was eliminated.
Yes, the high income decontrol and the vacancy decontrol are both part of the same deregulation statute. So in J51 buildings, neither form of deregulation is any longer permissible.
Another thing that should be added, that as with high-income decontrol not being available, if there is a J51 tax abatement, what's known as a unique and peculiar circumstances rent increase is also not available in a building with a J51. And landlords, although it is available if you're stabilized under the Emergency Tenants Protection Act, and many, many buildings are concerned about landlords who are applying for those rent increases, if there is a J51, they can't get it, and tenants should know about that.
Alex, would you tell the listeners how they would find out if they're in a J51 building?
Yes, there are a number of ways to do it on the Internet. The Department of Finance has a website where you can look up your building to see if it's on a list of buildings that currently receive J51 benefits. And if you know your building's block and lot number, you can go to a different part of the same web page and look up the entire J51 history of the building if it exists. There's a drop-down menu, and you can pick a tax year and determine whether or not a J51 application had been filed and approved in any tax year going back probably 20 or almost 30 years.
And then they can either decide on a class action suit or an individual suit or contact a tenant organization and proceed from there.
That's correct. If the building is currently receiving J51 benefits, or if it last applied even 10 or 15 years ago and the benefit period is going to continue for several more years, they might consider filing
Okay. Now to something that no one seems to be interested in but me. The United Nations wants to know if affordable housing is so tough to come by in the city that it actually violates human rights. And they have an independent expert, Raquel Rolnick, who is going across the country to speak to tenants, and then she will address the General Assembly in March. I think that's great that... Nobody cares. Nobody cares. I was so excited when I read that, and everybody goes, meh. Are we that jaded? Look what happened with the J-51. Nobody really? Well, you thought, Ed, you thought it was going to happen, right?
Yes.
Okay. We're approaching the end of the program. I'd like to, again, Alex Schmidt, congratulate you on your win at Stuyvesant Town, Peter Cooper Village.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me this afternoon.
And I hope to do more programs, and I hope you'll be available.
I will be.
And Ed Rosner, former criminal lawyer, why can't we get him all on a RICO?
That's a fact-bound question that I can't answer without the facts before me.
All right. Thank you both. Alex Schmidt, Ed Rosner, for joining us on the Arts Magazine, and thank you for listening. The Arts Magazine will be back next Tuesday at 2. I'm Marianne Miller.
Hi, this is Ethan Young, the local election supervisor for WBAI. This is the sixth part of a series of campaign statements by candidates for the WBAI station board. WBAI members are voting their choices for 9 board seats. There are 41 listener candidates. The first statement is from F. Frank Lefevre.
My name is Frank Lefevre, and I want to know, what's the point of being a voice for the voiceless if nobody is listening? As a member of the programming committee, I know how few listeners we had, even at our peak 5 or 6 years ago, and how seriously the number has declined since then. In the finance committee, I've seen the decline in financial support, with listeners at other Pacifica stations helping to pay our bills. If we're serious about doing more than hearing the sound of our own voices, we must make a serious attempt to tell 18 million potential listeners that we exist. I have distributed hundreds of my own leaflets, but obviously that's not enough. I have seen ad campaigns approved by 2 general managers shot down by Justice and Unity saying they'd attract the wrong demographic. If we can't bring together the right or the wrong kinds of listeners, we're not fulfilling the Pacifica mission. Instead of excluding the wrong people, we should increase our audience by advertising BAI to everybody. Please learn more at takeforwardwbai.org.
That was F. Frank Lefevre. Next is Chude Mondlane.
My name is Chude Mondlane, and I signed up to become a candidate for WBAI's local station board because I want to contribute to the station community, broaden the voices heard on the local station, and help the station achieve financial stability. For my part, I see WBAI as a media outlet that combines my commitment to progressive politics and diverse art forms. I'd like to see WBAI strengthen the cross-fertilization between its political and arts programming, and I'd like to see the station better tap into the voices and activism of New York City's youth. Elect me, Chude Mondlane, and I will be committed to help the local station board play a productive and supportive and honest role in improving the network and the station, and I hope the board can serve as an effective liaison with the listener community and the potential listener community. Feel free to contact me via WBAI.org. Thank you.
That was Chude Mondlane. Next is Gil Obler.
Hi, folks. Gil Obler here. I'm running for the WBAI Station Board. I've worked as an organizer, treasurer, and fundraiser, and representative of Green Party organizations and campaigns, as well as nonpartisan progressive community action projects. My goals are to help lower station operating costs, do creative off-air fundraising, restore fair labor practices, reinstate fired workers with back pay, end censorship on free speech radio, the gag rule currently preventing on-air discussion of the Pacifica coup. It speaks volumes that an amazing group of progressive community organizers have joined together to form the Take Back WBAI Coalition. The current LSB majority have treated former management, current staff, and listeners with contempt and arrogant disregard. How we treat each other, particularly those with whom we disagree, how we win is just as important as that we win. Please support me and the Take Back WBAI Coalition. Together, we can take back control of our lives and our station.
That was Gil Obler. Next is Teresa Palmer.
Hello, friends, or perhaps I should say family, because that is how I feel about WBAI and all the producers, staff, and listeners. We are a beautiful family of like minds and souls doing some of the most important work in media today. My name is Teresa Palmer, and I am an independent listener candidate. I would like to take a more active role in helping keep the station healthy and vibrant. I know about health. As a registered professional nurse for 20 years, I have seen what it takes to work towards health. In a hospital, it takes the whole team working together, and I have found that a positive, vibrant love is what makes the organization gel. As a volunteer with WBAI, I work in many capacities, and I understand our family from the inside. That is what I stand for, positive, vibrant, and essential love. I may be reached at WBAI.org.
That was Teresa Palmer. You can hear more candidate statements at 7:55 a.m., 2:55 p.m., 5:55 p.m., and 10:55 p.m. For more information about the election, go to our website, www.wbai.org.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive. Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.